organizations in the world who were involved in this, from Le Monde to Der Spiegel, etc. How did you all coordinate your work together and then speak about what happened at the AFP office?
So let me start by how we all work together. Forbidden Stories was critical in managing this project. You can imagine 50 journalists in several different countries. So coordinating this project is definitely a challenge. But we all worked on all the stories. So once we've determined, after the initial stage of doing some research about the different cases, once we've identified certain leads that we were going to follow, we created these subgroups, and anybody who's interested in one of these leads would join this group. And then we did what we refer to as radical sharing. Everybody was just radically sharing whatever they were doing. I was doing interviews. Somebody else was doing, like, forensic visual analysis. Someone else had access to documents. And everybody shared everything. And that's how, it's the power, really, of this investigation. I wouldn't have been able to do it alone. Arij, my organization, wouldn't have been able to do it alone. And none of the other organizations would have been able to do it by themselves as well. Let me speak about, like, one of our major findings. On November 2nd, the AFP offices in Gaza, there was an explosion there, and the result was a huge gaping hole that you can see from the outside, but also on the inside, a lot of damage. AFP regularly, as a common practice for foreign offices in Gaza, send their map coordinates, their location, to the Israeli military to tell them that this is a media office, and it's not to be targeted. So when asked about what had happened, initially the Israeli army said that, you know, they didn't recognize that anything had happened. Then they said maybe there were clashes and this was like as a result of the debris. And there were condemnations and, you know, requests for investigations, but then nothing really happened. And then we started looking into this. What we had really to work on this was the live footage from the camera that was stationed in the AFP offices. When the staff left in October after the Israeli evacuation orders, they left an unmanned camera that was connected to solar power. And these explosions were caught on camera on the live feed. And we were able to identify four strikes. And through analysis that was done by both Le Monde and Paper Trail Media, an organization in Germany that was part of this collaboration, and which was confirmed by an audio analysis done by an organization specializing in audio investigations, and by six weapons experts, we were able to determine that this was actually direct firing by an Israeli tank from around 3 kilometers away. We've identified the specific area that the firing happened from, and we were able to get satellite imagery that showed that 2 days before and the day after, there were tanks in this area. And then while we're looking at all of this, I came across a story of a journalist who had been injured, and I noticed that he was injured on November 2nd in an attack on a local media company called the Palestine Media Group, PMG. And then we found out that they were actually on the same street, just a few hundred meters away, in this tall building, the tallest building in Gaza, on the 16th floor. So we found out what time this other attack had happened, and it turned out it had happened about an hour before the AFP attacks. And actually, I remember this moment. We were in a meeting, a virtual meeting, with the AFP, who the AFP team was working with us on this particular story. And we were, like, you know, checking the kind of the range of time. Let's check the live feed around this time. And we found that it was caught live on camera. So there were two attacks on two buildings, four strikes on AFP, at least one strike that we know of on the offices of PMG in this other building. The difference between the two is that at the PMG offices, there were four people, including two journalists, and one of them got badly injured in his leg. So this was one of our main findings. The Israeli military, we of course approached the military for a response before we published. And in its response, it still insisted that there was no targeting of the office.
And Hoda, could you also speak? Two of the other critical stories you covered were the attacks on the Press House Palestine. Explain what Press House did, the services it provided to journalists in Gaza, And what happened?
So one of our other major stories, and this one we worked closely with The Guardian on, was about Press House. It's this very unique and special organization in Gaza that was considered by many as a second home to journalists. It provided a lot of training and workshops to journalists and a lot of services. It was created by a man called Bilal Jadallah in 2013, so last year would have been the 10-year anniversary. And journalists would go there to attend workshops, to attend discussions. It was also considered a place like any foreign dignitary that would visit Gaza would definitely go to visit Press House and to visit Bilal Jadallah. And we heard a lot about the breakfasts that they held in their garden. The pictures from before, really, when you see them and when you look at them, it's quite disheartening to see what's happened to Press House since then. So after the war, Press House had actually secured 84 flak jackets and press helmets before the war. So when the war started, they sent out a message to the journalists saying, we have those, this protective gear. You can come to Press House and you can start getting it. And they started giving the journalists this protective gear. They also opened up their offices. They had strong internet. They were connected to solar power. And journalists started working from Press House for the first few days. And then the evacuation orders happened in October. On October 13th, some of the journalists left to the south, and some journalists stayed in Gaza City, including Bilal Jadallah, who didn't want to close Press House and wanted to be there to continue serving the journalists. Within 2 weeks, from November 6th until November 13th, three Press House staff journalists were killed. On November 6th, Mohammed Al-Jaja was killed in his home with his family. On November 13th, Ahmed Fatema was in the home of his in-laws. A missile hit the building. His son was injured. He took his son outside to ran to take him to the hospital, and then Ahmed himself was killed supposedly with a drone. And then on November 19th, Bilal Jadallah, who had insisted until this moment to stay in Gaza City, decided that he was going to go south and meet up with his family who had already left Gaza City. He took a route that was designated clearly by the Israeli military as a safe route to head south. There's these maps that were being distributed and posted on Facebook, and they had this route in yellow, clearly saying you can take this route to go south. And he was in the car, and he was killed with an explosion. We think it was a tank shell, and Bilal Jadallah was killed that day. In addition to that, the three, of course, a big, huge loss. You speak to anyone in Gaza, and you mention Bilal Jadallah, and you mention Press House. And the day that Bilal was killed, you know, I remember speaking to several journalists on that day in November, and just like the shock was beyond. The loss is really insurmountable. We also managed to speak to a witness who stayed in Press House. He is the former financial director and a good friend of Bilal Jadallah. And at some point, he had to flee his home, and he went and he stayed in the building that housed Press House for a few weeks. And during his stay, an Israeli tank came and stood directly in front of Press House and fired at Press House. They were fortunately not harmed, this person and his family, but then the following day they left, and a few days after, Press House was completely demolished. And you can see the pictures, and it's quite sad to see the pictures of this lively, like, you know, buzzing place with the journalists in it, and then you see it now, and it's just like rubble.
Hoda Osman, we only have a minute to go, but I wanted to ask you about this other crucial story that appeared in The Guardian that was headlined The Gray Zone, how IDF used some journalists in Gaza as legitimate targets. If you can explain very briefly.
So the news organization that lost, the media organization that lost the most journalists was Al-Aqsa, which is considered to be affiliated with Hamas. And Harry Davis, who's the reporter on the story, looked into this and spoke to a spokesperson from the Israeli military who said, yes, we consider you know, people who work for this media organization as terrorists and legitimate targets. But then after the publication of the story, the Israeli military kind of retracted and said that the spokesperson does not represent our views and that's not our view. But the fact is that the majority of the journalists who had been killed are journalists who had worked for this media organization that is affiliated with Hamas.
And towards the end of your report, Huda, you talk about the journalists who have survived so far and what their conditions are. If you could explain what you found out from them, the people they've lost, the number of times they've been displaced.
Thank you, Nermeen, because a lot of the time the attention is, of course, on this like huge number. But it's important to pay attention also to the journalists who are still there. We did a survey; over 200 journalists responded, and it's just like it's tragic. 98% had been displaced. Many, many have lost family members. Around 50 had lost immediate family members, including, tragically, 11 journalists who lost one or more of their children. In addition to that, their homes have been destroyed. They've lost, half of them had lost their jobs. A lot of them lose their jobs because they lose the equipment that they use to report. So it's really, really bad for the journalists who are there right now, especially when no foreign journalists are being allowed into Gaza to assist and to help with the reporting. We depend fully on these journalists who are reporting the story, but they are the story themselves.
You write at the end of your article in The Intercept, quote, Rashdi Al-Sarraj, a journalist who ran an independent media company that did work for the BBC and Le Monde, wrote on October 13th on Facebook that he intended to defy an Israeli army order to evacuate Gaza City. He said, we will not leave, and if we leave, we will go to the sky and only to the sky, he wrote in his post. 9 days later, Al-Sarraj was killed by an Israeli airstrike on his home in the Gaza City neighborhood of Tal al-Hawa. I want to thank you so much, Huda Osman, for joining us, executive editor of Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism, a partner organization in the Gaza Project, also president of the Arab and Middle East Journalists Association, joining us from Amman, Jordan. But we're going to turn right now to our next guest in Gaza.
As we continue to look at the targeting of journalists in Gaza, the deadliest place on earth for journalists, we go now directly to Gaza to speak with a Palestinian journalist who's at the heart of this story. Shrouq Aila is an independent journalist and producer in Gaza. Her husband, Rashdi Sarraj, was also a journalist who founded the local production company Ayn Media.
On the morning of October 22nd, Shrouq and Rashdi were at their home in Gaza City with their 11-month-old baby girl when an Israeli airstrike hit their building. Rashdi was killed in the attack. In the months since, Shrouq has continued to work as a journalist and runs Ayn Media herself. Like so many other families in Gaza, she's also been forcibly displaced several times. Shrouq is joining us from outside Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. Huda quotes your husband and what he said, the head of Ayn Media, which you have now taken over after his death. Can you talk about what happened to him and what you're doing on the ground there in Gaza as you try to continue his work and explain what's happening there every day? I think we may have lost. Hello. We were just seeing an image of Shrouq, but she seems to have lost our signal. We're going to go to a break, and then hopefully we'll have her back when we come back. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, committed to bringing you voices not just about Gaza, but from Gaza. And sometimes we have difficulty connecting. Stay with us.
Oh,
Crying, he left by Los Carcas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. In a moment, we're going to Bolivia, where an attempted coup has just been subverted. But we are attempting to stay in Gaza for a minute to speak with our guest on the ground, Shruk Aelia, who is an independent journalist and producer. Her husband, the journalist Roshdi Siraj, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in October. He ran Ayin Media, which Ayla now heads. Ayla, if you can talk about what happened to your husband and what Ayin Media is, the organization you now head, and how you try to cover Gaza every day from the ground. We're speaking to you in Deir al-Bala, Gaza, in front of a hospital. If you could, Shruk, tell us what happened to your husband and what is Ayin Media that he's headed and now you head.
All right. When this genocide started, it was on the 7th of October. At that timing, we were traveling abroad. Rushdie and I and our daughter, Dania, she was at the timing 10 months old. And we were traveling for a work trip outside of Palestine. And then when this genocide hit the Gaza Strip, we decided to immediately cancel everything and speedily return to Gaza Strip. Because when it comes to wars and you are just outside, you die different times of not being with your families and also not joining in doing the duty of documenting the reality on the ground. So we arrived the Gaza Strip in the second day of this genocide, and we immediately moved to the family house of Rushdie because our house is on a seventh floor, and when it comes to pumpings, it's better to be in lower floors because of the shrapnels and also because of the non-stopping shakings of houses because of the heavy rockets. So we decided just to move to his family house, and Rushdie decided to go and document alone. Why he decided to go to document alone? Because in the first day, on the 7th of October, the Israeli army launched several rockets on the north of the Gaza Strip, and it actually hit our team. One got killed, two are missing so far. We are not even able to know whether they are under the rubbles or they are kidnapped in the Israeli jails, and hopefully it's the second option. Like we believe it's never alive and being in a prison, but at least having them alive is such a sign. But so Rushdie, after losing one of their members, Ibrahim Lafi, and losing two members, Haytham Abdel
الواحد أن نظل وحيدي from the AIN media team members. So he decided to go and film alone, and I decided to stay at home with our little baby. And this, to be frank in this, that I never decided to stop him doing this documenting, because it's such a duty, and when you decide to be a journalist, so it's a journalist for a life, it's a sentence for a life. And then after being able to do the document like every day, like on Sunday the 22nd of October 2023, like let me say, directly after 2 weeks of the beginning of this genocide, Rushdie was preparing himself to go to do the documenting inside the ambulance, and I was at that timing hesitating about him leaving to go to do the documentation inside the ambulance, because since this war started, lots of ambulances got attacked and a lot of medics got killed because of the severe attack against the health workers. So I was like, I was convincing him to try to not to be in the ambulance and just stay at the hospital, like watching over the ambulance movements and so. But unfortunately, like, we had that discussion, and then he decided just to go. I said no. First you have to ask your family about going in an ambulance, and then after we finally decided, like, it's totally fine to go to do his duty, to do the documentation inside the ambulances, and how the health workers are really doing hard work in terms of brushing and going through risky areas to rescue the casualties. So we decided he can just go, but Rushdie decided that he will never leave the house before we have breakfast together. So he gathered all of his family members, and he insisted at that time to have the breakfast together. And like, his mom told him, like, you can just leave, have your breakfast and just leave, you are quite busy, you know, what is ready for the breakfast. But he really insisted to have the breakfast. Maybe he has that sense that it is the last breakfast, and he wanted to leave us a memory in this. So once we started to have the breakfast at 11 a.m., we heard a very massive explosion, like too close to the house. This explosion actually made the table to move. So we immediately rushed to the ground floor, because there's that believing that when it comes to too close bombings, you better just to go for the ground floor or to the stairs. I know it's not a safe area, and but you know, that sense of you are not controlling your feel, because you're just hearing non-stopping bombings nearby. So we rushed to the ground floor. And we stood together. We were 9 members at that time, and I was holding Rushdie's hand, and he was quite close to me. I was holding Dania in the other hand, and she's a baby. She was 11 months old. So I was holding his hand and just discussing with him of how nearby are those explosions, because we are feeling that things are like falling, and there are like glasses are getting broken. Like, I was super afraid, all of us. So in a plank, like before the explosion, in two seconds, Rushdie just moved from being my side, and he stood in front of me. So basically he gave me a shield, and after 2 seconds I was just trying to let him get it back where he used to stand, and everything went into dust. Like, in just a second, everything went into dust. At that moment, I thought that I got a low sugar pressure, because, you know, when it comes of with bombing, of when you are attacked, you will never hear the explosion because of the air pressure. So the first thing that I wasn't able to see anything, it was just dust. Then I started to smell the gunpowder, the concrete, the burned concrete, and the dust. So I tried just to wave my hand, searching for my husband, for my Rushdie, and I wasn't able to find him. Like 1 minute later, I felt there was something very heavy, very heavy on my legs. So I tried to search, what is that? Because I cannot just move my legs for this. And then, unfortunately, it was Rushdie, and he got hit in his head. But it was 1 centimeter, a crack in his head. But I could see at that moment the brain from inside. So I tried to hold on my breath. I called the ambulances, and they said, we apologize for not coming to the area because the area is being under heavy attack, and it's not stopping since 20 minutes. So I called my brother. He's a doctor. I described to him the injury of Rushdie, and he told me that you cannot do anything for him. Try to walk and go to the hospital. So we carried Rushdie, and we walked to the hospital. It took us almost 15 minutes until we arrived at Al-Quds Hospital in the Tel El-Hawa neighborhood. But he didn't make it. Like, he immediately left us in, but he didn't just left us, he also left a reality of that Israel has been deliberately targeting the journalists in the Gaza Strip.
Shahrukh Ayla, we want to thank you so much for being with us. I'm so sorry you had to share that painful story. Our deepest condolences on the death of your husband. Shahrukh is an independent journalist who has taken over Ayn Media, which her husband headed, the journalist Rushdie Siraj, killed in an Israeli airstrike in October. We thank you so much for being with us from Deir al-Bala in front of Al-Aqsa Hospital. We're going to end today just by talking for a moment about what happened in Bolivia, where thousands filled the streets of the capital, La Paz, to confront military forces who tried to carry out a coup against the democratically elected president, Luis Arce. Hours after the coup failed, Bolivian authorities arrested the rogue military commander, General Juan José Zuniga, and his alleged co-conspirator, Navy Chief Juan Arnez. The President Arce has sworn in new heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. We will speak online with our guest, who's in Cochabamba, Bolivia, Catherine Lederer, who is director of the Andean Information Network. You can go to democracynow.org for that report. But we have to end now. We wish a very happy birthday to John Randolph and let you know about a job opening at Democracy Now! We are currently accepting applications for a director of development. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Shrifado Kaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick, Matt Ely, Anna Ozbeck, Emily Anderson, and Buffy St. Marie Hernandez. Tune into our specials next week on July 4th and 5th, and you can watch any broadcast and any podcast wherever you get your podcast. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.